This is one in the sequence of interviews that comprise the oral history of Computer Simulation Project, sponsored by the National Science Foundation. We are here on the campus of the National Institutes of Health in Bethesda, Maryland today, the 21st of May, 2013. And we are interviewing Mr. Philip J. Kiviat. And my name is Richard Nance. Philip J. Kiviat created the General Activity Simulation Program, GASP, in 1961-63 at the Applied Research Laboratory of the United States Steel Corporation. Originally intended for internal use within U.S. Steel, the language was adapted for use on limited computers by Professor Alan Pritzker. GASP II, the initial Pritzker version, became widely used and was extended and enhanced in various ways. In 1964, Mr. Kiviat left U.S. Steel to join the RAND Corporation in Santa Monica, California, where he worked with Harry Markowitz on SimScript 2, incorporating some very advanced features. Both in concept and implementation, SimScript 2 was used in a number of military and political studies. Carried into the commercial domain as SimScript 2 Plus and later SimScript 2.5, the language represents a very significant contribution to simulation application and education over many years. Mr. Kiviat was a major technical presence in the early operations of FedSim, initially an organization created to supervise performance evaluation of computer systems in the federal government. He is also known as the originator of the Kiviat graph, an innovative technique for providing assistance to decision makers facing multi-criteria decision challenges. Mr. Kiviat, may I call you Phil?
I hope you will.
Okay, thank you. What led you to simulation?
Well, I was a student at Cornell in the 50s, 55 to 60. And one summer, there were no summer jobs. Could not find a summer job. Summer before that, I had a job at the Long Island Lighting Company placing the location of transformers on maps. Not a very illuminating job, but it paid something. Couldn't find a job that year, and I stayed over the summer and worked for Professor Robert Beckhoffer doing Monte Carlo simulation work. Bob was interested in sampling theory, and he would come up with the sampling approaches, and he would come up with answers analytically. And the question was, could you do a Monte Carlo simulation to get a probabilistic view of the outcomes? So he hired me. I knew nothing about Monte Carlo simulation, which wasn't simulation in the way that we understood it. That was mainly just sampling. And I knew nothing about random numbers, so I had to learn. And I did this for a while, and Professor Beckhoffer got some usable results and published them. And I talked about what I was doing at some of the internal seminars. And the word got around that I was, quote, the simulation, the Monte Carlo guy, which became the simulation guy. Mm-hmm. And all I knew about was sampling numbers for Beckhoffer's statistical work. And that's how it started.
Well, who introduced you to discrete event simulation?
Well, that didn't happen until I got my first job out of school. Must have been in 59, U.S. Steel was recruiting for the U.S. Steel Research Center in Monroeville, Pennsylvania. Some senior executive, I was told it was the president of U.S. Steel, I had no verification of that, decided that they needed to have a discrete event simulation model of a steel mill, an open hearth steel making shop, so that they can study essentially logistics problems. So they came to Cornell, and they wanted to talk to some people who knew about simulation. Well, really, nobody knew much about simulation. Dick Conway and Bill Maxwell knew more than anybody else, but they were looking for a summer job, for a job. They were very happy being professors. So I interviewed, and I got the job. And so I moved to Monroeville, Pennsylvania, and learned about discrete event simulation by figuring out how to do it.
Were you familiar at all with any other uses of simulation in the steel industry, either in this country or abroad?
Well, after I got the job, I figured I should do some research and find out about it, so I wouldn't have my first day on the job being completely ignorant of what I was doing. And I got into Keith Tucker's work and the language work he had done. So that's the way I started. And I realized that, yes, this is for real. It can work, it does work, and it could make a very useful contribution to running a business.
And so Katie Tucker's work was an influence, I gather, on GASP. Perhaps from a distance, are there any others who influenced you in, or you look upon as having had an influence in your development of GASP?
Well, at the time, let me get back a little further than that. The way I had to do this, I had to build a simulation model of an entire open hearth steel making shop, and I knew nothing about making steel. I was given a team, a small number of industrial engineers who were supposed to help me become knowledgeable about the steel making business so I could build a model. And I had to go out in the steel mills, hard shoes, safety glasses, hard hat, walk around and learn how it worked. So I had to look around and figure out what was going on and how do you do modeling. And then I had to talk to the industrial engineers about what I was trying to do. I couldn't. They didn't have any computer skills. And I had to write some programs. I couldn't talk to them about computer languages, because at that time everything was either in assembler code or, if you were really advanced, in Fortran, which didn't help a whole lot. So I realized what I really needed was a language to talk to them with. Well, what are the elements of the language? That got me into doing some research and talking to people and came up with the ideas of activities, which is what Tucker did, and processes and events, which are the endpoints of an activity. And I had heard from some people I knew what was going on at RAND with the SimScript work. But I hadn't talked to anybody there, and so which was basically the same thing. So I took all of that and came up with the idea of GASP, it's called a General Activity Simulation Program, because that's the name I gave it. I guess I got like GASP, but it really deals with events, because events are the endpoints of activities. Other people dealt with activities in a different way, with different modeling formalism, but after all, the world only works one way for real, and so how you look at it can vary with what you're trying to do. But I came, I spent some time, and U.S. Steel was very good about that, going to conferences, talking to people, and I came up with the idea that if I did it in terms of events, that was a language that the engineers could understand. And of course, we didn't have anything like they have in SimScript, entities. I mean, all we had was Fortran, which is what I decided to write it in. So there were some things that were easy to talk about, and other things were more difficult because the language wasn't developed. But I succeeded in putting it all together, and we built a model.
Did the experience of working with faculty, students, or the computing environment at Cornell impact the early work on GASP or the later work in the development of your career?
Well, I went up to Cornell as a mechanical engineering student. As part of the curricula, they had basic computer course. And Dick Conway was the professor. And Bill Maxwell, I think at that time, was his graduate student, although I may be a little off on the credentials at that time. But Conway and Maxwell were the people who taught me about computing, and I knew something of what they were doing, and I just kind of picked it up. I had a job later on as a graduate student in the Cornell Computer Center, which at that time had a Burroughs 220 computer, a very hands-on machine. And so I was a programmer for professors who wanted to use the computer to do research. And so that got me involved in an interesting way. There was a very, very well-known faculty member who was studying predator-prey relationships. And he had these equations, and he wanted me to program the equation so he could do generations of the life of these populations, and which I did. And what would happen was you'd crack all this stuff out, and then you'd have to print it all out so we can look at it. And the way he had written everything, not the way he had written it, the way he had done the equations, is I would do 100 iterations and print out 100 lines, and very often, 60 of the lines or 80 of the lines or even 100 of the lines were identical. And they'd be chunking away, you get piles of paper. And he said to me one day, is there any way we cannot produce so much paper? He says, I have no idea how to do that. I know the equations. So I said, yes, it's really very simple. And he said, you can do that? Okay, so putting in a very simple command to not print the line, it was the same as the previous line, is there anything simpler than that? I can't think of it. But here he was with these complex equations of the relationships between the predator and the prey populations. He had no problem with that, but he thought that I could not reproduce a line was magnificent. So there was a lesson there. The lesson there was, the user doesn't think the way you do and doesn't necessarily understand what you're doing. So be very careful about what you say and what you hear, because they're often very, very different depending upon the people that you're talking to. So that very simple experience working in the computer center actually affected everything else I did, because I have been a critic throughout my life of what are the requirements, and are the requirements interpreted correctly. And even going forward to my federal work, the biggest problem in the IT world today in the federal government, where they write these big programs for which they spend hundreds of millions of dollars, why do they fail? It's always in the requirements. So I learned that very early.
How successful were you at finding someone on the steelmaking side to help you on the modeling and interaction in the development of the program side?
Oh, I had some very good people on that side. One fellow who I haven't talked to since the early 60s, Bill Blattner, was very, very helpful. Interestingly enough, all of the people in the plants that I went to who knew nothing about operations research or any of this were all very willing to help me. And I think it was partly curiosity, but I got a lot of attention from them. Mm-hmm. I also learned something very important there. we built these models. You know, a model is nothing but an abstraction. And if you don't get the abstraction right, the model is worthless. And after, when we started building these models, very often it would run and I would get out these strange results. And I wouldn't know whether the model was wrong or the programming was wrong. And because the programming was all done in Fortran, it wasn't easy to find out where the problem was. And I would go to the industrial engineers and I would say, ran the model, these were the inputs, this is what I got out. It doesn't look right to me. Could something like that happen? And they always had a way of saying, well, yes, if this parameter was this and this parameter was that and this happened and that happened, you could get that result. And almost invariably, they were wrong. It was an error in the program. So another lesson that I learned very early.
Describe your motivations and concerns in making the move to RAND from U.S. Steel Applied Research Lab.
Well, I pretty much did what I was asked to do at U.S. Steel, and there were some people who took over what I did. The opportunity to go to RAND came up because Harry Markowitz was there, and I think it was probably Allen Ginsberg, but somebody told me that they were looking for somebody to work with Harry. And that was just such an opportunity, A, to work with Harry, mm-hmm. B, to go to RAND, which was a fabulous place to work, C, to leave Pittsburgh to go to Santa Monica. Okay. And it was just the right thing to do.
I'm just a little surprised. It might have been Dick Conway who mentioned that, because he had a working relationship with RAND in that period. So you went there specifically to work on SimScript 2?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how would you describe your role in the interaction? As I recall, there was a change in the programmer somewhere between SimScript 1.5 and SimScript 2, or right after SimScript 2?
Well, SimScript 1.5 was a CACI product. It was not a RAND.
Oh, okay.
You had the SimScript work that was done at RAND, led by Harry, and he had a programmer, Bernie Hausner, who was a RAND employee. And at some point, Harry teamed up with Herb Carr to form CACI, and because RAND had no trademark proprietary interest in its software products, they took SimScript and made it a proprietary commercial product. They named it SimScript 1.5, and they did some things to differentiate it. But Herb Rand kind of ran the business side. Harry spent some part of his time there. He was working at both places, and there was no conflict that anybody saw. In fact, while I was working at RAND, they paid me, who knows what, but it wasn't much, to do an index for the SimScript 1.5 book that they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
So you had SimScript going to SimScript 2 at RAND, then you had SimScript 1.5 at CACI.
Okay, and then SimScript 2, my recollection is, had a programmer that succeeded Hausner named Villanueva.
Richard Villanueva worked. When Bernie left, we brought in Richard Villanueva, and essentially Richard and I finished the SimScript 2 work after Harry made all his intellectual contributions. And what you had to do was just make it work and get the book written. And so I took over that. Richard was the programmer. And we had a very good programmer, Joel Ehrman, who was an IBM employee. Do you remember then, in those days, if you had a big IBM installation, which Rand did, you got three programmers. So one of them was assigned to us, and he wrote most of the IBM code that we needed to make the I/O and stuff like that work.
Rand was, as you have mentioned, was extremely active in several research areas in simulation during the mid to late 1960s. Could you characterize the climate and perhaps identify some persons with whom you worked during this period?
There were some interesting things going on. Allen Ginsberg and Paula Oldfather came up with an idea called programming by questionnaire. Mm-hmm. Because one of the things Rand was interested in was building logistics models, which is what Conway and Maxwell were interested in, scheduling, job shop scheduling. And so what they did was they generated a SimScript model from a questionnaire that you filled out, which gave you the attributes of the logistics system. You know, was it first come, first served, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And the idea was to turn programming for that type of work into a check off the boxes. And so Alan and Paula did that. And I, you know, we were all in very close contact and we were all friends, and so watching them. So that was important to see how that went. There was also a fellow whose name I cannot recall. He was a very, very well-known mathematician. And he was interested, because this was the time of the Vietnam War, he was interested in developing strategies for essentially fighting guerrilla operations in the jungle. So he said, assuming that there are so many guerrillas and they behave this way, what's the optimum strategy for us to employ to combat them? So I built a simulation model for him, built it in GASP, because we weren't so, you know, I was doing the SimScript work. I wasn't applying anything. I was building a language.
You were not parochial, so no, to speak. No.
To study, you know, strategies for deploying, you know, assuming the enemy is doing this, what's the optimal strategy for countering it? So I did that for a little while. It was fun, but didn't go anywhere that I know of. And he eventually passed away, and I regret not remembering his name. He was a very, very well-known mathematician.
So the climate was pretty much you didn't have boundaries on projects or efforts or on organizational subgroups. It was pretty much a collegial type of let's talk about the problems.
When
let's talk
I
about the challenge.
Got to Rand, it was what Rand had been doing before that, and did it for a while afterwards, is they would just hire the most brilliant people they could find. Like, I could name them, but
listen. George Danzig is one I
yes,
can remember.
Yeah, yeah. And Philip Wolfe, and let them do what they did. And you know, lunchtime people would go down to the cafeteria, and they'd be playing Kriegspiel, which is, you know, blind chess. I mean, just a very intellectual place. And so you never knew what anybody was going to be doing, and it didn't have to be relevant. Because the idea was you do these very, very good things, and every now and again, you know, something will be very important that comes out. Well, about the time, I guess it was about the mid-60s, the Air Force decided to make RAND relevant. So you had to get money, you had to show that it was relevant to an Air Force mission of some kind. And that's when it became, I think, for some people, less fun to work there.
What factors then were prominent in your decision to leave RAND?
Well, I had gotten SimScript 2 finished, written the book, and I said, well, gee, why don't I do the same thing that Harry did? So I, along with Arnie O'Keen, who was the GPS guy from IBM, we formed a company, Simulation Associates, and took SimScript 2 and made it into SimScript 2 Plus, which was a proprietary aspect of that. And we did R&D, and we taught courses. And one of the interesting parts of that experience was at RAND, all there was a mainframe. And so when you wanted to do something, you went in, you punched up all these cards, and you had to wait for the turnaround, which could take a day or two, depending upon your priority. And it was very slow to get anything done. So when I formed Simulation Associates, a company called National CSS at that time, which was a Canadian company, had a time-sharing service. So I convinced them to let me use a certain amount of hours each month to build SimScript 2 Plus in exchange for letting them have the language available on their system. And so now we had a terminal, and we did work effectively in real time and turned things around very, very rapidly, which changed the whole trajectory of the development. And that was my first experience with that. We had had JOS at RAND, but it was a toy compared to a much more powerful system like National CSS had.
Am I wrong, or is it that JOS was sort of an Air Force developed extension of Jovial, or?
Yes. Okay. Well, see, at that time, everything was Project RAND.
Right.
So everything was Air Force money. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it was very, very well ahead at the time. I had a JOS terminal in my office. And it was just there for people to use. I never had any familiarity with people using it for projects or anything. That it was a helpful tool. Now, so when I left, it was to try to start a business, make some money out of it. By that time, I had a wife and two children, so making some money was interesting. And we tried to do it with Simulation Associates.
Mm-hmm. What eventually happened to Simulation Associates?
There was a big recession in 1970, 71. And what we were doing was selling our services to mainly R&D companies, all of whom had their budgets cut. Mm-hmm. So the training budgets were cut, the R&D budgets were cut. One of my greatest sales successes was I sold a SimScript 2 Plus compiler development to RCA. And the week that we signed the contract, they announced they were getting out of the computer business. So timing is everything. So that was the end of that. So what happened was all the money dried up.
Right. Now, did you go directly then to FedSim, or was there some interim?
No.
Tell us about that interim period.
What I did was we had Simulation Associates. We had a handful of people. It was about five or six or seven people. So they found places, and we had one asset, which was SimScript 2 Plus, which we sold to CACI. And that became their version of SimScript, the follow-on to 1.5.
That became SimScript 2.5.
Yes, okay. Because they had been, we were competing, and they had announced the availability of 2.5, but they didn't have anything. So we sold SimScript 2 Plus to them, and they renamed it, and that's how that happened. No, I did some consulting work for a while in the Los Angeles area, and then I went up to Northern California to a company, System Control, in Palo Alto, and did some work there for a while in the simulation area. And I wasn't there very long. It was less than a year. And I got a call from an Air Force captain who I had met as part of my RAND work. And he knew what I was doing. And he said, the Air Force is going to set up an organization, very unusual, called the Federal Computer Performance Evaluation and Simulation Center. And it was going to do computer performance evaluation and simulation. The idea being to help people use simulation to buy new computers and do computer performance evaluation to tune existing computer systems. And we're looking for a technical director. We're just starting this organization. We have an Air Force colonel who's going to start it, but he's a fighter pilot. Okay. So we need somebody who knows the business. Could you suggest somebody? Well, I had been in the business long enough that I saw where all the money was, which was in the federal government. And having just gone through this recession in the private sector, because we didn't have any federal business. So I said to my wife, why don't we go to Washington for a while and learn how to deal with the federal government? And she wasn't all that happy living in Walnut Groves in Cupertino. So I recommended the best person I knew for that job, me. And surprisingly, they said, really? And I got the job. Having been in the government for a long time, I was aware how little I knew when I did what I did, because I didn't go through the normal recruitment testing process. Of course, it was less rigid in 1971 than it is today, but they said to me, really? Well, fill out this. I filled out what was essentially an application, and I got the job.
Well, I, in all honesty, think their surprise was that you were interested in the job, because I think you would have been recognized as eminently qualified for it.
Yeah, but you know, when you do federal hiring, the most qualified people don't always win, for all kinds of reasons. Mm-hmm. So I got there. And I was going to stay for a short while, and that was 40 years ago. I haven't gone back to California. And it was great because we were just starting. It was a true startup operation. The Air Force general that we reported to was happy to have it because he was the head of IT for the Air Force. They called it different things than it was data processing, you know. And he said, I'll let you do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to give you any money, and I'm not going to give you any Air Force business. If you can go out and find people who want your services and you can get them to pay for it, that's wonderful. And you'll do things that are of value to the Air Force and we can borrow them. But I'm not going to sponsor this operation financially. I've got my own budget to worry about. So we started work. We had no budget. We had initially he kind of was self-financing for a while until we had some money. But we had to go out and sell our services, which was model building and analysis. And we could do things the way the right way to do them. We were so new, we were invisible to most people. Later, when we became successful, they were always second guessers about what we were doing, but at the beginning, nobody knew what we were doing. Those who did know thought we were going to fail. So we had a simulation division, directorate they called it. And at that time, it was mainly SCRT, if you remember that. There was some computer, they called them computer simulators, but they weren't. They were mainly just numerical ways of estimating things. And we had an analysis division, and we had a performance evaluation division. And what we did was get jobs from agencies who wanted to know what computer to buy, so do the analytical work to figure out what they wanted, and do the evaluations required. Because at that day, there was the number of computer vendors, they were all mainframe vendors, was the bunch, most of whom don't exist anymore. And the way you did an evaluation was you ran benchmarks. They supposedly all had COBOL compilers, which were the same, but they weren't, because one COBOL program wouldn't run on all of them. So it had to be the same COBOL program tailored to fit the peculiarities of each machine. And then you would run these programs and see which one did the work fastest or whatever. It was very expensive. The manufacturers didn't like it. It cost them a lot of money. It cost us a lot of money. So somebody said, we ought to simulate these things. So that got us going, and we started looking at simulation approaches, and we looked at the SCRT and the COMRES, what they had, and then the thing I did with FedSim then is Don Cozy at RAND had developed ECSS, which was a computer system simulator written in SimScript 2. So we hired him to finish that. And then we had a bunch of people who used it. And then we had the analysis people who were mainly analytical modeling and other things. And then we had the computer performance evaluation people who were using hardware monitors and software monitors. Which don't exist anymore. Well, the hardware monitors don't anymore. But you had to find a way of understanding what was going on inside the machine in order to tune it and do things more efficiently. And so I became very active in the computer measurement group and friendly with Ken Collins. Ken Collins was the founder of Boole and Babbage. He really invented the software monitor. And he was the one who coined the name software engineer. He wrote a book, Software Physics. And until the day he died, which was a couple of years ago, he wanted to make software more professional and more algebraic, if you will. And so he coined the name software engineer, and I'll tell you a story. In 73, there had been enough work going on in evaluating computers that people were starting to say, there's got to be an easier way to do this. Why can't we just come up with a number that will be a number that measures the effectiveness of the efficiency of a computer? So you could say something like that, well, our problem sets are such and such, we'd like something with the power of 4. And that would mean some certain classes of computers would be acceptable. And so people wanted a simple way of evaluating things. Well, most computers had different architectures. So whenever anybody said, let's do it, you got down to how you might do something, you couldn't do it because architecture A didn't have the same properties as architecture B. So everybody was trying to do this, and in 1973, there was a conference held out in San Diego, sponsored by the ACM and a lot of government people, National Bureau of Standards, which is now NIST. And the idea was to find a way to represent computers so you could evaluate them more easily by looking at their properties. Well, after 2 days of doing this, nobody came up with anything, not a single point of agreement. But during that meeting, people started talking about computers that they were having success with and that they others that they weren't having success with, and people would get into vernacular. And they would say things like, this computer for this application is just sick. Okay, end of story. I get on the plane to go home, and I took along with me a copy of that, the current issue of the IBM Systems Journal, which I read very seldom. And it was an article in it written by a couple of cardiologists on, I don't have the...
Diagnostic?
No, let me, I have it written down.
Okay.
Somewhere in my notes here, I have it written down.
I read that journal, the IBM Systems Journal, fairly regularly, and I found some interesting papers there.
Analyzing Patterns of Illness. It was a spring of 1973 issue. And what these doctors had done was they had looked at people who had healthy hearts and people who had, in the midst of having heart problem, who had been treated, and they drew and they picked up key variables. And they found that if you portrayed these key variables, you could tell by looking at the picture what the status of this person was. Because if you had a healthy heart, you always got the same pattern. If you had you were in the middle of having a heart attack, you had another pattern. And so I'm reading this article and saying, you know, what's the difference between a computer system and a heart? No difference. We talk about them differently. The variables are different, but the ideas are the same, because unless the computer is a completely autonomous thing that you never know what it's going on, certain conditions will produce certain effects. So I went back on the way, I thought about it, on the way back from this conference, which produced nothing. Oh, some papers that were interesting, but didn't address the issue that we went out to do. And came back to FedSim, and I got some people who went out and did monitoring. And I said, the next couple of jobs that you do, I want you to think about this. And I told them about the idea of selecting key variables, some whose values were good if they were high, some whose values were good if they were low, and putting them in a circular display. I said, why don't you go and do this? So we talked about the variables that might be useful, and let's see what happens. So we did that, and a woman at that time, her name was Ruth Broman, came back with something, and I said, Eureka, this is repeatable. And we came up with the idea that if everything was ideal, that the best possible picture you could get would be a star. Mm-hmm. And that if something was I/O bound, because didn't have the I/O capacity you needed, you got a certain picture. And if it was CPU bound, you got another picture. And it was very useful, because when you deal with people and you show them numbers, they don't know what the numbers mean, but people are very good at pattern recognition. And later, so I talked to people about that. I gave a couple of talks, and it was Ken Collins, who was at that time on a kick, that he didn't think the people in the computer business honored their own well enough. And he was thinking, you've got Ohm's Law, and you've got Faraday. And you've got, why don't we name something after ourselves? So he wrote an article, and he called what I had done a Kvyat graph. Okay. I can live
why
with
not?
That. So this kind of got picked up, and we made it a standard part of what we were doing. And the more I thought about it, the more I realized that the answer that I got back was what every psychologist knows. People are very good at recognizing patterns. They're not very good at dealing with collections of numbers and trying to figure out the relationship between the numbers. And if it's a statistical situation, it's even worse. And so it got picked up. And in fact, for some number of years, if you Googled Kvyat graph, you got dozens of articles from politics to astrophysics where people were taking the idea of putting data on a circle and saying it was a Kvyat graph. And I said, what did I do? Did I invent the circle? You know? But it was just that it's a simple idea that people never thought of using the way I used it. But that kind of made my position in the computer performance measurement group very good. And I was very, very happy to see that happen.
Well, we actually used the Kvyat graph as our representational overall measure of software quality.
Mm-hmm,
in
mm-hmm.
later work, I don't know if you encountered any of that, but we did.
Yeah.
A couple of questions that just trying to go back in history and remember how things were. I wonder if you had an encounter with the sort of, at that time, traditional argument between hardware-oriented people and the software-oriented people, and the use of emulation. And I remember in particular a guy named Bob Rosen from Sunny Buffalo, I think it was, and they designed a machine to do emulations of almost any type of instruction set or architecture, different arithmetics. Was that an issue in FedSim or in your dealing with FedSim customers at all, whether you should use emulation or not?
Never came up. Hmm. And if it had, unless there was a commercial product that you could buy to do it, we wouldn't be interested. Mm-hmm. But I always viewed the world as being too volatile for emulation. And the fact that requirements are always changing, you had to do something that was more flexible from what I saw. But no, I never was involved in it. We didn't have any emulators. And I we were never asked to do anything.
The work of the computer performance and evaluation SIG within ACM. Were you involved with that, or did you interact with them in any way?
Oh yeah, I was. Yeah, for I forget whether it was 1 or 2 years, or one term, I was the president of the computer measurement group, and I was involved with the CPEUG. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I tend, like lots of people, I guess, I get involved in something and I get to the point I want to be and then I go on to something else. So when I got to FedSim, I was very involved in all of those things because that was part of our business. But then the more I was in Washington, I realized that where the real interest was, my real interest was in not doing technical things, but helping people solve problems. And I got involved in the first company I was with. I was busy writing proposals and talking to people about solving problems. And eventually I got into managing technical people and then into business development. And I got further and further away from any of these interests because it seemed like, well, for one thing, that's where the money was. And that's where the bigger problems were. And I left the technical stuff behind. I mean, only returned to it when it applied to the bigger issue that I was concerned with.
If I could just perhaps retrace something that I wanted to ask about but didn't. In that experience with RAND and that environment in Southern California, there were, I can remember also, a couple of other players, the System Development Corporation, and I believe we've talked before about a fellow named Mike Lackner.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell us a little bit about?
Well, you know, System Development Corporation was an offshoot of RAND, and so there was a lot of interchange between there. And Mike and I got along well and talked a lot. And what was the system that they had? SIMPAC, was that it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it was, I guess, at its time a reasonable thing to do, but it was overwhelmed by GPSS and SimScript and the other things. Mike was a very thoughtful guy about simulation in the abstract.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I recall SimPAC was a fixed time incrementing clock, which didn't lead to efficiencies in most cases.
No. It was like my professor at Cornell who wanted to print out every line, even though they were identical. Click, 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 click.
You've mentioned a couple of external motivations, wanting to help people in solving problems, or that's where the money is, show me the money. Were there any other external motivations for your moving away from more technical to more business development?
Well, I just gravitated more to a higher level of concerns. You know, rather than help somebody build a model of some environment, why do you want to do that? What exactly is it that you're trying to do? And what's your view of the environment? So it's just a higher level, really.
And I guess another sort of retracking, but I think it's important to capture it, is there were a number of conferences or workshops held in the mid-60s on simulation programming languages. Can you tell us about those and how they impacted your work?
Well, they impacted my work greatly. John Lubin from the University of Pennsylvania and Dan Tycro, who is the University of Michigan, had a conference for a number of years in a row at the Wharton School on simulation. And they had people come from really all over the world to talk about their language. And I went to that for quite a few years in a row. And as a consequence, met a lot of the people who were doing this. That's the first place I think I met the GPSS people.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the same time, but independent of it, there were conferences going on in Europe. And I know, because somebody asked me the question once, for 10 years in a row, I went to London to take part in conferences and see people, and it was all about simulation. So, and the people that you encountered there was an incredible mix of people. If look at the world, you've got Harry Markowitz, won a Nobel Prize, not for his simulation work, but he was a Nobel Prize winner. Tony Hoare, who in Europe was involved at that time with simulation languages, with languages in general. Today he's got the highest awards there are in the programming, the computer science world. John Buxton, Ole Johan Dahl, who did Simula. These are all the people that came together year after year at these meetings. So it was very, very exciting time. And I was very, very happy to be part of it.
I can remember in particular that 1967 NATO workshop mm-hmm. on simulation programming languages, where all of those you've mentioned, in addition to Donald Knuth from this country and Christopher Strachey, just the luminaries in computer science were there discussing simulation programming languages.
Mm-hmm. I didn't go to that conference because I couldn't get funding for it, but I would have liked to have gone. Yeah.
Right. I wish I could have been there too, but I was a graduate student and no hope of funding at the time. What would you identify as the aspects of your education and professional experience that were most critical enabling you to achieve success?
Well, if you look at it from 50,000 feet, when I went to Cornell, the mechanical engineering program was a 5-year program. And that's because you basically had a year's worth of liberal arts. And you had to take courses in public speaking and things, you know, English. And I think that broadened me and broadened my horizons to an extent that I attribute a lot of my future to. Yeah.
Well, it's clear you've been an excellent writer. I've read and still consider, as does the rest of the field, your RAND reports as classics. '67 on just the nature of simulation. What is simulation all about? And then the programming languages oriented one commented on the differences in the worldviews. Mm-hmm. And by the way, for the first time, I could then understand them myself. And then your work with George Fishman on the statistical aspects too.
Yes. Well, George was important. Languages, up until that time, with SimScript, there was no thought given to output. Harry started it with SimScript, and I tried to take it further with SimScript 2. Some of that, the statistical insights mm-hmm. came from George, but to show you how sometimes you don't do the right thing, or maybe you do, but nobody recognizes that it's the right thing. One of the things that always drove me crazy when I was programming is when you dealt with Fortran, say, or even COBOL, you had to define a field length. And if you had the wrong field length, you wouldn't get any output. The program ran for 2 hours, and what did you get? Nothing. So with SimScript 2, I said, what you are going to get in the field length that you specify was as much information we can give you about the number at that time. So, and if you only allowed one digit and it was a very large number, we'd give you the order of magnitude. You know, I mean, anyway, mm-hmm. I thought that was a big deal because I had wasted so much time in modeling on outputs that I didn't know what they were. I never heard a word from anybody about that being important or not. But simulation is an iterative event. It's a process of using a model to learn things. And at the beginning, you don't know as much as you do at the end. So you want to look at things somewhat broader and then more narrowly. And so to put the facilities in a language to get as much out of it at the time seemed to me a very reasonable thing to do.
Phil, was your work in simulational performance evaluation used as you anticipated?
Well, basically, yes. It went in directions other than what I thought it might. I never thought the Kvyat graph was going to take off as it did, and I would be known for that. To me, it was a useful way of analyzing situations. I never thought of it. In fact, if it wasn't for Ken Collins, it would have been just another article that people read and said, hmm. But you put a name to something, and all of a sudden it takes on a flavor. So that did. Simulation. I think the thing that was most helpful to many people at the early days was what you referenced, the couple of papers I wrote on simulation language concepts and the idea of architectures and just clear up the world. You know, architecture is very important. And the analog to that in the literary world is vocabulary. Okay? If you don't have words, you don't have concepts. And if you don't have concepts, you can't think. So putting a name to something and distinguishing that name from another name is very important. And very often, people don't do that. And I've kind of always looked at the world that way.
Your prior comment coupled with that one makes me remember a saying that I cannot remember who uttered it, but it was so, and it might have been J.C.R. Licklider, the early director of Project Mac. The purpose of computing is insight, mm-hmm. not numbers.
Absolutely correct. Yeah. Absolutely correct.
Looking at your work in either simulation or performance evaluation, were there any unexpected results? Anything that surprised you, maybe in a negative way?
Not really. At the risk of being facetious, some of the things that I put in SimScript 2 that I thought were so great that nobody noticed, that surprised me. They were supposed to notice that. But very often, your view of work that you're involved with is too short-sighted, and you don't really see it from the big, which is why I don't enjoy, in the job I have now, I don't enjoy writing proposals as much as I enjoy critiquing them. Mm-hmm. Because then the question is the proposal you just wrote and you gave me to read, is that responsive to the solicitation where somebody's asking you to tell them how you're going to do something? And very often the proposal reads very nicely, but it's not responsive because the people are so close to it, they don't see that what they're doing is writing what they want to write and not what the customer is asking them to write. So I've gotten more, you know, everything I do winds up back at the same place.
What aspects of your technical contributions or research or service contributions do you regard as having had the greatest impact?
Well, I think I just answered that. I think the early papers on simulation concepts, and then I think the Kvyat graph idea, which is immensely simple, has had the greatest impact. And the essence of the idea is just look for patterns, don't look at numbers.
From your vantage point, a sage professional, what advice would you give to a student entering the field of simulation?
Well, when I was going to MIT in the 60s, to talk to the people there in the simulation laboratories. There was a sign when you walked in. SINSFIT, S-I-N-S-F-I-T. That's all it said. Now, this was a place where you had Jay Forrester and all these very brilliant people. And on asking what that stood for, I was told, simulation is no substitute for intelligent thinking. Because you have a model doesn't mean it's right. Because it gives you answers doesn't mean that they're right answers. So you have to think about what it is you want to do and what you've done represents. You know, the whole world, it's a complex world. And a model is nothing but an abstraction. You abstract the physical world and you get a static description of it. You abstract the dynamic world and you get a dynamic description of it. And then a simulation model is putting the physical world, real or imagined, through the dynamics of what you imagine the dynamics of the real world are. Both of these models can be wrong. And you can have a model that produces wrong results that look right. So you have to be able to look through all of this and say, does this make sense? And as you just said, what Licklider said, the idea is insight. So when you vary things, do they vary in the way that you expect them to? Because you can build a model that has, the model is only valid over a certain range, and then because the logic changes, you get an answer that makes no sense because you cross the boundary. So I think I would tell somebody, be humble.
Yeah, I think what I'm pulling out of what you were saying there is the difference between interpolation and extrapolation. Over a range of input values, the model may be valid, but then when you extrapolate beyond perhaps the data on which the model was originally constructed, it's not valid any longer. And that's a real danger that we face. Comment on the observation that has come through in some of these interviews here at the National Institute of Health. We tend to keep driving the complexity of our systems higher and higher. And seemingly as a consequence, the complexity of our models grows. Are we, in doing so, sometimes abdicating that very important human capability you just mentioned, our ability to abstract?
Absolutely. There are two principal reasons why these big simulations projects fail. And they're never technical. It's not that the language was inadequate or the computer was too slow. I mean, we've left all of that behind us. It's either because the model is too complex, because people try to put more into it than you need. You know, the word parsimonious is the word. The model need only be as complex as it needs to be. So you don't have to over elaborate everything. And that's not an easy thing to know. That takes some thinking. And the other reason is because of the requirements. When you give somebody requirements, how do you know they're right? If you asked, the typical thing in the federal situation is you ask the user what his requirements are. He'll give you one set of answers. If you ask some contracting officer what the requirements are, he'll give you another set of answers. If you ask some techie person, he'll give you another set of answers. And so what are the right answers? So when you say to somebody, I want you to deliver a system that does this. What is the right this? And my feeling is there isn't enough thought given at that end. If you remember, I think it was you who got me down to Blacksburg in 77, mm-hmm. where I delivered a talk on model-centered management. That's where I think simulation deserves to be, that you look at the models to come up with outcomes, not outputs, and to study the consequences of things, and to think about the consequences of what you're doing and not the outputs. For example, if you do have the requirements wrong, what are the consequences of coming up with answers with these wrong requirements? That is, how much extra work should you put into getting the requirements exactly right? I think that's the what I would tell somebody who is just getting into the field, is don't look at the numbers, looking at the outcomes. Do they make sense? Do they take you where you want to go? Do the factors that influence them make sense as being the right factors? And then, of all things, it's the consequences, the consequences in the bigger sense. And too often, when you see natural disasters, well, the problem with public policy, if you look at what happened with Katrina, did they build those dikes strongly enough? Okay, they said it was going to be a force 5 hurricane, but they only built them to a force 3 because that's the money. Well, what's the consequences of being wrong? Those are the real problems. And they're outside the model. But I think the modeler should discuss them.
Is there a question that I should have asked you but did not?
I can't think of one.
Well, I want to thank you for taking your time to take part in this history of computer simulation, which when it's placed in the archive, the simulation archive at NC State, will be accessible via internet to anyone all over the world.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.